Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Ed Veesters is the most accomplished American mountain climber. Over the past couple of decades, he has climbed Mount Everest more often than most people have been to the dentist. He's also climbed virtually every other mountain worth mentioning, including K2, which he regards as the most deadly of all the monsters. That's why his new book is titled K2, The Most Deadly of All the Monsters. Not really. The book's subtitle is Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain. When I had the opportunity to speak with Ed Veesters recently, I began our conversation by asking him what made K2 so dangerous.
Well, we chose the word dangerous because rather than deadly, which is more of a statistical definition, dangerous can be an opinion or an idea that you label something with. And people, when they go to K2, they're so enamored with the fact of trying to get to the top. They're willing to do a lot and willing to risk a lot to climb it. And because of that, people have problems and die on that mountain more than they do probably anywhere else statistically.
So the danger comes from the increased willingness to take risks rather than perhaps the terrain itself.
I believe so. But it is the combination of the willing to take the risks with the kind of relentless terrain that you have to deal with on K2, which makes it so hard not only to climb, but once you get to the top and if you used all your resources to get up, there's very little left for you to get down with.
Ed, I kept my introduction short because I want you to characterize yourself a little bit. What would you say is your most significant achievement as a climber?
Well, I just completed in the spring of 2005 an 18-year project, which I called Endeavor 8000, where I set out to climb the 14 highest mountains in the world that are all over 8,000 meters, 26,000 feet. It took me 18 years to do that. I had a lot of successes along the way. I had a lot of near misses. But that would, for me, be my gold medal. That was my Super Bowl, to stand on the summit of Annapurna, which was then the 14th peak of that series.
Very early in K2, the new book, you contend that non-climbing journalists can never seem to get our stories right. What do the journalists get wrong when they write about you?
A lot of them, and I think a lot of the general public, have an opinion of climbers as we go out and we seek the risk. You know, we do it for the excitement and the near-death experience. And what I try to convey to people and talk about and teach is that, you know, we accept the risk that's there, and I try to manage the risk in a safe way because ultimately, you know, I want to climb the mountain, but the end goal is to make sure that I get home. And whatever comes in between there is kind of up to me, how I plan, how I prepare, the people that I go with, and the journey itself. So we seek the challenge, but we kind of have to accept the risk.
You have written before about climbing K2, which, as we've said, many people consider the greatest challenge for a mountaineer. In this book, you consider the differences between what you've written for public consumption and what you have written only in your diaries and journals. How do those documents differ from each other?
Well, I tend to be pretty personal and you know, kind of quiet in my thinking. And when I wrote the journals, and I kept journals on all of my climbs, and as I mentioned in the book, I never planned anybody else to read them, or I never planned to publicly showcase those. It just was a place for me to put down my ideas and my thoughts and maybe vent some of my frustrations that were happening on some of these climbs. And in this new book, we reflect a little bit on those. And although I didn't give away the majority, I kind of let out a little bit more for the sake of just saying, you know, here's what I actually felt and experienced on this mountain, K2.
Well, you write that you don't like to second guess or criticize the decisions made by other climbers, either on climbs that you're participating in or other climbs altogether. But in this book, you do seem to have found that temptation irresistible. What led you to start expressing that sort of criticism?
I don't think we were too harsh or too critical. I think what we tried to convey, you know, both David Roberts and myself, was we tried to just point out the obvious, how certain things go very well, how certain teams work together very well, and then there's the complete opposite. And we tried to filter through what had already been published, what had, was already available, and just kind of define a little bit more what goes on these trips. And we're actually able to talk to people that weren't able to previously express what had actually happened on those climbs. And, you know, a lot of the stories we read, they're very romantic and glamorous, but the behind the scenes stuff, you know, the voices of other people that were on those trips often don't get told. And I think that's what we tried to do. And I just wanted to kind of make examples again about great teamwork, bad teamwork, good leadership, bad leadership, with a little bit of an opinion.
Can you give us a more specific example of somebody who isn't really pulling his weight, somebody you've encountered in that situation on a climb?
Specifically, probably not, but in general terms, you know, I've seen and been on climbs where the majority of people are really putting in a lot of energy and effort during the weeks and weeks of buildup of supplying camps and fixing rope and breaking trail. And then there might be a few or one or two people kind of in the background, maybe just kind of floating along a little bit and not really contributing, thinking that if they save themselves and save their strength and energy, they might be able to go to the summit later. And it's happened on other teams where the actual leaders of the teams seemingly have selected those summit people at the beginning and kind of save them for that end when they want the strongest people to be available to go to the top. Whereas I've always felt that your opportunity to go to the summit should be based on your contribution throughout the expedition. And you have to be able to show that I put a lot into this. I should have the opportunity to be picked to go to the top.
Of K2, which you characterized at one point in the book as the full meal deal of mountaineering, you write that if companies try to commercialize that climb, I guess the way that that has happened with Mount Everest, it will be a sad day for mountaineering. Why is that?
Well, it's such a, for me, it was such a test piece. And I think it is for many avid, not necessarily professional, but very experienced climbers. We go to K2 to test all of our skills, and it is relentless, and it is also very rewarding in the end. It's much harder to climb than Everest, and I think it would be very difficult to start guiding large groups of people up the mountain. They would have to need a whole nother level of skill beyond what you need for Everest to climb K2. And to see droves of people attempting the mountain, you know, it would be a sad day. And in fact, this summer, of multiple expeditions and attempts on K2, nobody succeeded, whereas there was multiple ascents of Everest. So right there and then, you can see the defining nature of how hard K2 is and how difficult it is actually to climb.
I wonder if this attitude about who should be on the mountains and who shouldn't be has anything to do with your contention that if climbing mountains like K2 and Everest wasn't extremely dangerous, there'd be no point in climbing them.
For me, it's not the danger that I seek. It's the challenge. And it just so happens that there are risks involved with climbing these mountains. We try to manage the risk. Smart climbers go to these mountains prepared with intelligence, with planning, with training. And in my version, I'm allowed to climb the mountain if it lets me, if the conditions are good. You know, on Everest, things are commercialized. And I'm not saying at all that we should regulate who can go and who can't. You can never do that. You should never do that. If thousands of people want to gather and try to climb K2, everybody there has the right to do that. That's kind of the freedom of mountaineering. And there shouldn't be a committee that handpicks the people that go or shouldn't go. I just want to make sure that the people that do go to these mountains have the right experience and the proper training and hopefully the right reasons as well. You know, not to say they got to the top, but to actually enjoy the journey and the process along the way.
I think my favorite single sentence in this book comes in the epilogue, and it reads as follows: climbing Everest again seemed reasonable. You've been on the mountain when people have died there. You've seen that firsthand, and you've helped rescue people in terrible circumstances as well. Is climbing Mount Everest ever, quote, reasonable?
I said it, and I believe it, yeah. You know, I've been there 11 times now, and I've reached the summit just recently for the seventh time. And I find that, you know, if I am skilled enough and smart enough with the right conditions, you can survive Everest. Doesn't mean you're going to go to the top if conditions don't allow, but if you do things in the right and conservative manner, you can go to Everest and make it home. A lot of things and a lot of accidents that occur in the mountains are based on human error. And if you analyze the statistics of why people have injuries and deaths in the mountains, it usually they've caused their own problems by climbing late, by climbing in bad conditions, by pushing themselves for the sake of success. And you really have to temper your ambition when you go to the mountains. You've got to weigh the odds. You've got to look at what works on that day and what might not work. And if you have to walk away, you walk away, knowing that the mountain's going to be there for a lot longer than you are. You can always go back.
Because it strikes me that that's a simpler thing for someone to say if he has devoted his life to climbing mountains and is sponsored to do so by, you know, companies that make mountain climbing equipment and that sort of thing. Very difficult thing for somebody who has saved all their money for one shot and then is told, hey, the weather's not good enough. Sorry, we're going home.
You're right. I mean, it is a hard pill to swallow, but I look at it exactly the same way. You know, even though I've got sponsors and companies that are supporting me, they don't make the decisions for me near the summit. And whether I succeed or don't get to the top, they're still with me because they like how I do and why I do it. And I think the same thing should happen when people, you know, when they pay money to go on these guided trips, when they save all their money and plan for a year for that once in a lifetime opportunity, they should hopefully know and be with the people that surround them that, you know, we have to be allowed to go up. And if it's not going to work, you know what? We had a great adventure. We had a lot of fun. I met some new friends. I traveled across the world. And yeah, I didn't get to the summit, but it wasn't a failure. It was simply a non-success because I wasn't allowed to go to the top.
It's interesting that from my reading the book, you seem to be down on people who seek firsts, the first person to ski down Everest, for example, or the first person to scale a particularly difficult peak in the worst of the winter season. Why is that?
Well, I think I separated those a little bit. I thought, you know, the first climb of Everest in the winter was an amazing thing, the first to ski Everest from the top. And I try to differentiate that a little bit between the people that are just saying, hey, I want to be the first this and the first that. And I want to make sure that when they're actually saying that, do they just want to be first or do they actually care about the whole process? Or do they just want to come back with this trophy or this label to say they were the youngest or the oldest or the whatever? I think that's a wrong reason to go and climb these mountains.
Nothing in K2, the new book, suggests that you're tired of climbing mountains, and you'd have every right to be, as far as I'm concerned by this point, but where will you climb next?
I have plans to go a year from now to Antarctica to climb Vincent Massif, which is the highest point down there on that continent. And I'm, you know, it's a place I've never been before. Other people have climbed it, but for me, it's a brand new adventure. And so I still have small goals, little adventures that I have out there. I call them my carrots, you know, things that I have to look forward to, things that I have to train for. So I'll just kind of keep making it up as I go along.
Ed Viesters is the author of K2, Life and Death on the World's Most Dangerous Mountain, published by Broadway Books. He joined me from the studios of NPR in New York. Ed, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
My conversation with mountain climber Ed Viesters will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking with J.P. Ricciardi. Until very recently, he was the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays, and as the second round of baseball's playoffs plays out, we'll be discussing how to reassemble a team that hasn't lived up to expectations. Regarding those playoffs, we'll also be speculating with various experts about the likelihood of the injection of snow, sleet, or hail into the gloom of the late October and early November nights, into which baseball's postseason will dribble. I'll also be talking World Cup and MLS soccer with Grant Wall, and Karen Given will have the story of a college soccer player who has returned from Iraq to resume his career. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.